work sessions.
No work sessions?
Hello, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It's Friday, February 9th, 2018. Welcome, everyone. We have three bills before us today. We have public hearings on three bills.
Thank you, Arnie, but no thank you.
I do want to start off by saying, as you'll see from the agenda, Senate Bill 1558, the Tumalo Irrigation District bill, has been removed from the agenda. You'll remember that we discussed this issue during Ledge Days in January and heard about the needs there in that district and in the basin, and you know, the attempt to address those with Senate Bill 1558. And as we discussed it, I did point out that we wanted to make sure that there weren't any unintended consequences from the changes that we were making. Needless to say, when you're dealing with water, things get complicated pretty quickly. But I do want to thank, we had a variety of stakeholders come together and discuss it. I think the ultimate decision was that it was going to be too complicated to deal with quickly, but that we really want to address the underlying issues and have a prolonged, detailed discussion of water transfer. And so that's going to happen during the interim. Beth has agreed to stay with me to do that.
That's amazing.
I think.
Yeah.
And so stay tuned for that, those of you who have a particular interest in water and irrigation. So we have, as I said, three bills today, and I believe that these will be easier bills to get through. And I don't know about you, it's Friday afternoon. I'm ready. I'm ready for this. I do want to say before we get started that next week is ends the first stage of this session. Thursday is the last day for bills to move out of committee that are going to, and so I've canceled next Friday's meeting. We won't be meeting next Friday, so enjoy your time. Okay, so with that, we have some legislators here on Senate Bill 1533, so I'm going to open that first. So I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1533. If Rep. Stark and Senator Knope could come up. And Beth, if you could tell us what this bill does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1533 has a -3 amendment, which is posted on OLIS. The -3 would replace the introduced measure and allow equine and equine-affiliated therapeutic and counseling activities in an exclusive farm use zone subject to local government findings and provided certain listed circumstances are met. We don't have any fiscal or revenue statements yet. No subsequent referral.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. I am Senator Tim Canope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. Last year, I had a constituent come to me with a concern about what is commonly known as therapeutic riding centers and their ability to operate in exclusive farm use zones. And we felt like it was best to clarify what they are doing and make sure that before there was any issue or problem that the 18-plus centers that are around the state are fully in compliance with Oregon land use law. And so I approached the chair of workforce for a committee bill. So thank you to Chair Taylor. This this bill is now before your committee, and we'd appreciate your serious look at this issue, because all of us, I think, appreciate the work that these therapeutic riding centers do in terms of PTSD and others for all sorts of people, including veterans and people who've had abuse or domestic violence. And Along the way, I picked up a partner in this effort, Representative Dwayne Stark, who has graciously agreed to partner on this effort, and I believe has a companion bill in the House. And we'd love to hear from him as well. So thank you for the opportunity to have a hearing and consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Knope. And just for clarification, so we're dealing here with both human and equine workforce. Is that right, in this workforce bill? Yeah. Rep. Stark, welcome.
Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative in House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And yes, I was excited to be part of this bill. For some reason, it seems in my four sessions, I've found a way to end up on a land use bill each time, even though coming into this building, that was a topic I didn't know much about, but I'm learning quickly. And one of the things that we've learned is if you're going to do a land use bill, there's a few partners you need to have. DLCD, Thousand Friends, and Farm Bureau, all of which got together and worked on this bill and presented to you the Dash 3 amendments. So the Dash 3 amendments, and I'll talk about the bill in just a moment, but really what we're, the Dash 3s are a gut and stuff. Although it's 65 pages, it's really 9 lines repeated on pages 29, 45, and 61. So it's 9 lines, 65 pages is what we're really doing here. So, and here's the situation. It was somewhat vague in the land use exclusionary portion of the statute that if someone was going to, we've said for a long time that, yeah, we appreciate equine therapy and hippotherapy, and you'll hear more about those at some point. But there was some confusion as to at what point does it stop being equine therapy? And somewhat kind of tongue-in-cheek example is that there are some counties that would think that as soon as you are not physically touching the horse, that the therapy is no longer permitted on exclusive farmland. So what that means is a child might go out and have therapy on a horse, and what would be logical is they would get off the horse, talk to a counselor for a little while, and may go back and forth. Well, if it's interpreted in the way of that they actually have to be on the horse or touching the horse, then that means that by the time you drive that kid back into the city, you're losing a lot of the benefits of the horse, or you keep the kid on the horse, which is tough to talk and have your therapy on the horse, or you super glue the kid's hand to the horse, or you take the horse into the city. These aren't very realistic options. And so we thought the best way to deal with this was to go ahead and clarify that, yes, as long as it's equine affiliated and it's part of that whole thing, they don't actually have to be physically touching the horse. Now, that was a somewhat overly stated example, but we have our constituent, or Senator Knope's constituent, and now my friend, here to testify and give you kind of the more detailed analysis of what the problem is. Excited to be here and be part of this. So we have Jeff Campbell, we have Joyce, whose last name I forgot, I tried to write down and butchered, here to speak to you today, and then we also have someone from the Farm Bureau to testify. So if you don't mind, I might sit next to them while they come up, if there aren't any questions for us.
Actually, I'm going to ask your indulgence to allow us to close the hearing, this mm-hmm. hearing, because we have Representative Brocksmith to talk about another bill, and Senator Roblin perhaps can join him. So I'm going to
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Recess. Recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 1533, and I'm going to open briefly a public hearing on Senate Bill 1550. And Senator Roblin and Representative Brocksmith, we'd love to have you come up. And Beth, could you tell us what this does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1550 has a Dash 1 amendment posted on OLIS. The Dash 1 amendment replaces the introduced measure and authorizes the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to adopt record-keeping requirements for persons who deal in food fish for commercial purposes. The requirements may include information sufficient to show the source and disposition of food fish and any other information the commission deems necessary to trace the chain of possession of the fish.
Thanks, Beth. Senator Roblin? Rep. Brocksmith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, and committee, David Brocksmith, State Representative, House District 1, which is Charleston to the California border over to West Cave Junction and back up to West Roseburg. What you have before you is really just a legislative tool to allow our Oregon Department of Agriculture and ODFNW to work with our fishermen that, in various ways, more importantly, and with our crabbers, so that we can identify and catalog events with regards to domoic acid, as we know is becoming more prevalent over the years, and have the ability to, without getting too messy, because it's messy to back a crab before you cook it, having the crab eviscerated before you cook it pretty much eliminates the domoic issue. And in doing so, we can work with our fishermen so we don't have the number of closures that we do over the course of the season due to elevated domoic acid test results. We'll also be able to have more limited closures in various areas, so that you don't have blanket wide closures that take up a lot more fishing grounds. And I believe the industry folks will be appreciative of that effort, because I know our fishermen would. So with that, I'll leave it to the Senator.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dembro and committee. For the record, Arnie Roblin, District 5 from David's district across the Charleston Bridge up to the west side of Tillamook Bay and then into Sheridan, Fall City, and Territorial Road in Lane County. The bill has caused a little bit more confusion than we had hoped, and that's why you see the amendments there. We are making sure if there are any other amendments. We thought we had it out and everybody had gotten to it, and then all of a sudden other people came in. So I have a few things that I want to put on the record that it doesn't do as well as what it does do. One, there's no intent to create new record-keeping rules for tribal members. Therefore, drafting an amendment to state specifically that Senate Bill 1550 does not apply to tribal members exercising treaty-reserved rights. We will make sure that gets in there, because that was never the intent. We've been working with Fish and Wildlife Department to figure out how do we track food fish, and in particular, crab. So what we're wanting to do is make sure that a boat comes in, drops off a load of crab. We would love the processor to know where that lot is, so when it goes off into the others, if it is found that it has domoic acid in it, we know what boat it came from and what part of the coast those crab came from. Because if you know that, you don't have to close the whole coast, which has happened a couple times. You have to maybe figure that out and talk to people about, let's not harvest in that particular part of the area until we get a clear sign. It used to be, once the domoic acid went, we didn't see it again. That's not been the case lately. It's been popping up at different times, and we've closed the whole coast down a couple different times after the opening of the season. And you've noticed that our season is starting much later because of warmer waters creating some problems. But we do want to track to find those hot areas if they pop up again. Also avoid the shutdowns I just talked about. We left in food fish because it includes crab, shrimp, razor clams, and others, because there may be other biotoxins or things that get in the food chain, and we want to have the ability to deal with them and to track things. We don't want it to be a big tracking system that's a lot different than we have now. We just need to make sure that we have control of the food as it passes through, so that if there is an identified problem, you can back it down and figure out where it's coming from. So we will continue to make sure that we get it exactly right, and there will be the amendments that are coming before we move the bill, or we'll bring it back next time, because we think it's very important for the viability of our fish. And as you heard, a couple years ago we had some E. coli problems with oyster, and they just closed the whole bays down. And our goal is to try to figure out, is it the bay, was it the processor, other kinds of things, where did that particular thing get introduced in the food chain, and stop it there, not just close everything down. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you both. Colleagues, questions?
Thank you.
Yeah, and let me just say, I think you have a question, Vice Chair.
Yeah, I kind of do.
Okay, before you do, let me just say that we have scheduled this for a work session on Wednesday, so the sooner we can get the amendment,
agree,
the better. Yeah.
Or we'll pull it whenever. Yeah.
This is reminiscent of a bill we had when we did farmers markets, trying to track down where strawberries and things came from.
Yeah.
Is this kind of, am I on the right track?
Yeah, I'd say you're on a similar track. This one's easier than that one,
yeah,
I think,
yeah,
in large part because there are only so many processors, and we have control over where it's introducing. It won't cover local people picking crab and doing stuff and concentrating it, but it will definitely give Fish and Wildlife a chance to follow the food through the chain and possibly to the restaurant and back again.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Hoover?
Follow up.
Thank you. When you say food fish, and of course you want it to include crab, do you anticipate a broadening to all types of bottom fish and everything?
This bill allows for that if there's a problem with any of those others. So that's why we use food fish, because that is, by law, the definition of all those things we harvest from the sea.
So
it's already big enough to cover those. There will have to be rules and other things, regulations, and it only is necessary when you have an outbreak of some kind or another. So hopefully this puts the process in. We're doing it for some of the other food fishes already. So if you look at what's happening with some of our salmon, they have a tag on it that tells you who caught it and what time in the ocean it was was swimming, because that's increased the value of that product. And they do very similar things in Port Orford for the rockfish and stuff they do, because
right.
they do it live. So you know the boat and the fish and where it came from. So
they do it currently?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
But we have
Representative Brock Smith.
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson. We have a live fishery in Port Orford that does that now, and they get a much higher price for their product. Just to add to Senator Roblin comments, you know, because the ocean, as you know, they have various temperatures and currents and upwellings and so forth that cause these domoic issues to really just be centered off the coast of Gold Beach, if you will. But yet then there'll be a closure from Lincoln City to the California border. So this really is just, we're trying to drill down the ability to just close off between, you know, Gold Beach to the California border, and then allow our fishermen still to fish. And then, you know, if we can get to an area where ODA has the ability to work with ODFNW to give an evisceration order, because the parts per million are such that can be allowed, then they can still fish coast-wide, and this will be able to track it. So.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Sorry, guys. Just a quick question.
Senator Benz.
We have kids growing tilapia and other things in various places across my district, or my former district. Well, both, I guess. So will they have to register? Like the Baker Technical Institute is growing these fish and then selling them to the local markets. Seriously. Working great, and it's making high school kids very enthusiastic about running their businesses. Does this apply to that?
We'll check on that because I can't tell you the answer exactly. It is not intended to. They do have to check their fish, and they have to make sure it's okay before they sell it. So I don't think it is as big a problem. But I will look into that to make sure, because that is a good question.
Chair Denbrough, Senator Benz, I believe it will, because it is technically associated with the food fish and doesn't reference ocean food
That's
fish
true.
In general. But as the senator said, there are already regulations in place to where they have to meet. This is only intended, as the senator's testimony said earlier, to apply when there's an issue in the food fish, and so therefore it would not apply until that issue had come up. And if that issue does come up, it should apply.
And the follow up,
yes.
So fish hatcheries that are raising trout for whatever purpose, would they be included in this?
Again, I will look at that, because I was really only looking at the ocean. I would assume if they're raising them to release them, probably not. If they're raising them to put into the market, then they already have ODA or Health Department and others checking that before it gets out there, so it shouldn't have a problem.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We now have, and thank you for allowing me to ask another question. We now have, because the Columbia River is open season on sport fish, we have many people out there catching crappie and actually putting them in there, selling them in restaurants for sale. Would this cover that?
It should.
Okay.
But I will check on that and make sure with my, it gives them the ability to cover it. That doesn't mean they're going to choose to do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you both. Okay, so I'm going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 1550 and reopen our public hearing on Senate Bill 1533. And if I could have Joyce, Jeff Campbell, yeah, I'm sorry, Joyce Korshkin, yeah, Jeff Campbell, and do we just have two chairs? Well, let's just do you two.
Representative Stark wanted to be close because
he's
using the counseling aspect of this for himself.
Don't break the furniture now.
So is this a counseling thing for you, Stark? Sitting next?
Very thirsty.
Okay.
Just wanted to make sure.
But not equine.
Okay, Jeff or Joyce, whoever would like to start.
Can I go, Jeff?
Yes, Chairman Dimbro, thank you very much. Members of the committee, my name is Jeff Campbell. I'm from Bend, Oregon, here representing Healing Rains Therapeutic Riding Center. I must ask your indulgence. I am not a professional lobbyist, so I don't do this for a living. So be patient. I'm just a simple map maker who's married to an incredible woman that a couple of decades ago wanted to do some pretty special things with horses other than just have a bunch of pasture pets around. Out of a relationship that she forged with another lady there, they formed Healing Rains, and we started doing what their motto is, to heal with horses, doing traditional therapeutic riding. And I think it's important for the committee to understand the difference between what is generally termed traditional therapeutic riding versus what's addressed in this bill, because they are two different animals, no pun intended. First of all, traditional therapeutic riding is a lot like traditional horseback riding lessons, where you go to a trainer and learn to ride. The focus, however, in therapeutic riding is we deal a lot with veterans with PTSD, with kids with all sorts of mental, cognitive, emotional, physical disabilities, adults the same, stroke, MS, all those things. So traditional therapeutic riding is that. Those activities are covered currently as outright uses and or some permitted uses on EFU lands. What we discovered as we started healing with horses is that there are a number of ways to heal with horses, and kind of the poster child, if you will, is of those activities is termed hippotherapy. And forgive me if you guys know all this, indulge me here, but hippotherapy is essentially, hippo is Greek for horse. It's essentially where a licensed physical therapist, just like would use a medicine ball and weights in a traditional therapy session, is trained to use a horse, the movement of the horse to strengthen core muscles, to improve balance, to increase strength in different areas. There is a portion of that therapy where, as Representative Stark indicated earlier, that is on the horse, traditional horse riding. But then the therapist and the client then will step away from the horse, move into an additional facility, an adjacent room, additional building there, and follow up on what they just worked on. We also work with kids that have learning disabilities, similar thing. There is a session that is with the horse, and then they'll step away and talk about what they just experienced, what they worked on. It is when you step away from the horse that a very good senior planner in Deschutes County, when he and I were having a conversation about this a few months ago, said, no, that you're in violation now of EFU laws. That is no longer permitted use once you step away from the horse. There are arguments all around that issue on the same planning department. What we want to do with this bill is remove that ambiguity. Just make it clear that if it is equine affiliated, it does not mean that you necessarily have to be touching the horse the whole time, but you're affiliated with it. So we've gotten together, as Representative Stark said, with Thousand Friends of Oregon, with Farm Bureau, with LCDC, to really hammer out a solution to this that everyone is comfortable with. And at this point, we have literally complete buy-in from all those groups and from our consortium of 18 or so of these therapeutic riding centers across Oregon, north to south from Union to the coast, and some communities up in several centers up in the Portland area, Eugene, Salem, Klamath Falls. So they're all across the state. I've invited Joyce Korshkin to join us. She is the executive director, she'll introduce herself, of the center in Heron Hill here and to give a couple other examples.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jeff. Joyce, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Dembro, Vice Chair. Thank you for having this hearing. I can tell you my name is Joyce Korsten. I'm the Executive Director of Alliance Counseling, the Center at Heron Hill in Canby, Oregon. We do equine-assisted and facilitated therapy there. In contrast to what Jeff was describing, all the work we do with horses is on the ground. So they're leading horses from one place to another, they're grooming the horses, and we use metaphor as a way to facilitate telling of a child or an adult's story. So that can be, we work with foster children, we work with children from abused homes, we also work with adults with depression and anxiety. And so one example I can give you is of a child that we had referred to us who was autistic. This child didn't speak at all, had not even spoken to his mother, and he was 8 years old. He wasn't in the public schools. They were trying to educate him at home. We were in treatment. He was in treatment with us for about, I think it was 6 to 8 weeks. And the instruction was just to have the child walk a horse over to a gate in the arena and walk back. So this child took the haltered horse, walked it over to the gate, and started telling the horse what was going on outside of the arena. It was the first time his mother had heard his voice. And so evoked a lot of emotion in everybody that saw that happen. Now he's in the public school system. He comes into the barn every week and greets everyone. So it was a life-changing experience. But the important thing about that is that it wasn't just that experience with the horse that made the difference. It was the time that was spent with him after that, speaking to his mother about what that meant to her and helping her learn how to facilitate more conversation with him at home. So that's my story.
Great, thank you. Colleagues, any questions for the panel? Yes, Vice Chair.
As you know, I always will. In reading this, Representative Stark, also on page 10 or 11, it covers the same thing you talked about on your other pages. I just have concern to make sure that we have clarity, and that's what I'm going for, because obviously you ran into trouble with downstream, what we have done downstream, and they interpreted it differently. So that's why I want to ask this question. It says that you can do it in an older building that's already an existing building that's already there, but or in a new building that are accessory, incidental, and subordinate to the farm. So I just want to get that clear on the record so that if anybody asks, we understand what they are, so that you can go build a new paddock or a new building that you can walk the horse in, and that would be accessory. But how would you prove that it's accessory to the farm if it's only for your therapy?
Yeah, if I might, Senator Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, that specific point was that provision was a collaboration between Thousand Friends of Oregon and Oregon Farm Bureau. I believe someone from the Farm Bureau is here and probably will be able to speak specifically to that. The idea, I can speak conceptually, the idea there was to get away from use creep, so that all of a sudden you start adding these buildings and now you've got more, therapy structures where they don't involve anything related to the formal intended use, in this case, equine use on the property, and that's where the incidental, subordinate, and so on to the farm use. So that provision is intended to speak specifically to that, if that makes sense.
We'll be hearing from the Farm Bureau.
Okay.
Yes, right. But the Farm Bureau will probably be able to speak much more intelligently. Well,
I see them. They're all yeah. Leaving. All I'm looking for is clarity so that you don't get those hurdles again.
Right. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Thank you all. Rep Stark, thanks for your facilitation. Let's hear from the Farm Bureau. And we have special consultant Samantha Bayer.
We don't want any horsing around now.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Samantha Bayer, and I am a third-year law student at Lewis and Clark Law School, and I'm currently externing with the Oregon Farm Bureau for this term, who I am representing here today. The Oregon Farm Bureau was happy to work with the proponents of this bill to help develop the Dash 3 amendments and to clarify that equine therapy is an allowed conditional use in a farm zone. As someone who grew up raising and showing horses, I understand firsthand the valuable role that horses can play in enhancing the lives of those around them, especially those who need emotional support. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and we urge your adoption of the Dash 3 amendments. And Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Olson, if I can speak to the question that you just raised. With the Dash 3 amendment, the main concern for us was in regards to new buildings. We wanted it to be primarily a horse facility with the therapy being incidental. So to give an example, a stable, a current stable that is then doing therapy versus a full therapy facility with one horse, if that makes sense.
Vice Chair.
Thank you. It's not that I'm concerned for the definition. I'm concerned for the people that interpret the definition downstream to make certain that they clearly understand that an existing building is acceptable, and we want an accessory, incidental, and subordinate to the farm use. In other words, if you built a hayloft and did therapy underneath it, I would assume that would be incidental to the process of farming and that you could use that. I want to make sure that we get it on the record for the downstream folks that it's clear that if this is done, it's done for the work of the farm, but in the meantime, we're going to do the therapy inside of there. Am I clear on that, or am I kind of crazy?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, we also shared that same concern and agree with you that it is important to make sure that the therapy is incidental down the road.
Great. Yes.
I don't know if this helps for the record. Marianne Cooper for the record, Oregon Farm Bureau. And I think to your point, there is developed in LUBA explanations of incidental and subordinates pulled from other statutes, but what Samantha said is exactly right. It's the idea that the farm use here is the horse facility, and that any other buildings, they can be built. They just, you don't want a whole therapy center with one stable. You want a stable, and it has a couple therapy centers, but the stable is still the primary use. And that is something the county determines on a case-by-case basis, but I think in this case we've been pretty clear that incidental and subordinate doesn't mean that it can't exist. It just means that primarily this needs to be a horse facility that then is adding therapy as opposed to a therapy facility that's adding a horse.
I think this is really good legislation. I really support it, but I would bet a milkshake that in a year or so we're going to have somebody ask a question, why can they do this on there?
Yes, and we can work with the carriers as well on carrier statements that make that really clear for the record.
And be clear that I don't want you to change it.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that, like I said, those people downstream understand the intent of this.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Great. Senator Roble.
Since you're both there, because I think it's really a clarifying. So I build a stable, and I attach to the stable two housing units, because some of my stable people are going to be here for a week and I want to have a place for them to stay next to the deal. Am I still okay?
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I believe so. I'm not, I will say I'm less clear on for housing, and we can make sure we get that cleared up on the record again in carrier statements. I believe so. I believe it would be, because I mean, tons of folks have like guest quarters in their stables. And I believe that's part of the allowed use of, that facility. And so my answer would be yes, but we can make sure that DLCD and 1000 Friends agrees with that and then make that clear record.
Agreeing with my good Senator Olson.
Yeah.
But I think, so two is okay. Could I have four?
if you add more horses, you can have six.
There you go. Okay.
Because the horses can use it also.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, I think that the clarification will be good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anybody else that wanted to speak to Senate Bill 1533? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1533 and reopen our public hearing on Senate Bill 1550. And we have three individuals who've signed up. Shannon Hurd. And Karen, are you coming up as well? Why don't we go?
Yeah,
let's go with the agency first.
Then we'll know clearly. They can answer the questions more clearly than I do.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We're here today to try and help with clarity on this, the rules that are existing and what the bill proposes to change. Our testimony is directed at the Dash 1 amendments. We feel that's the most clear version out there. Karen is with me today. I'll let her introduce herself, and she's going to cover this for the marine program.
Yep, Karen Brady, manager of the Marine Resources Program for the agency based in Newport. And I am happy to read the testimony into the record or just answer questions per your direction.
Can you give us like a 30,000-foot version of your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. I'd be happy to. I think, as Senator Roveland mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of confusion about the intent of the bill, and I would characterize the intent of the bill as augmenting authority that is already in place for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to improve the traceability of seafood authority for the commission to require for certain fisheries, given the need to have additional traceability in place. And the whole purpose for that in the language of this bill is to bring in the ability for the Oregon Department of Agriculture to use those records for the purposes of public health protection. Representative David Brock-Smith talked about the Dungeness crab fishery in particular, and this bill concept comes from conflict over the Dungeness crab fishery over the last few years as we've been experiencing harmful algal blooms, which accumulates in the tissue of the crab and can pose a public health threat. And so trying to improve the traceability of the seafood to get at protecting public health while maximizing our ability to harvest crab that are good crab and can be enjoyed by Oregonians and others. So that's the purpose of the bill, is to improve traceability, protect public health, and allow the fisheries to continue under conditions where there are harmful algal blooms.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you. And you use the term several times, and I really appreciate it. You use the term seafood. Senator Bentz had a question on tilapia in eastern Oregon. I had a question on crappie. If you were to change the term, a person that engages in taking, landing, buying, or selling a food fish, could you change that to seafood fish to cover just the ocean?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough and Vice Chair Olson. The language of the statute currently is food fish, as you've pointed out, and that is the authority. That's in the language that's given to the commission. Food fish covers all of our species, and currently tilapia or other cultured fish would that are covered by our commercial fishing laws would be subject to our records keeping requirements. The difference here is that this bill clarifies that an individual who is buying and transporting and distributing food fish both has to have a record of where they got that fish from as well as who they sold it to. So it's just adding that additional forward step records keeping requirement within the bill. It also then allows ODA for purposes of public health to have access to those records that are already required by the department and through the commission rulemaking.
Let me hear from Senator Brzezinski first.
So I'm just following up on your segue this. Could you actually do geographic food fish situated or located from a geographic area, in other words, getting off?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough and Senator Brzezinski. I think the example that we're living under right now might be helpful. Through the authority that we have from statute currently, which allows our commission to require records for who you got food fish from, we are living under rules currently for the crab fishery, which specifies that you need to track within those rules geographic location of where those crab are harvested from. And in that way, and again, hearkening back to Representative David Brock Smith's testimony or introduction of the bill, we have developed a set of harvest areas for Oregon so that we can precisely close off parts of the Oregon coast or precisely allow harvest of crab with evisceration in very small portions rather than saying all of Oregon is open or all of Oregon is closed. And that was done through the actions of developing those concepts with a Rules Advisory Committee, which we convened along with our sister agency, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, who is in the room and is happy to talk to you if you would like to talk to them specifically about public health issues. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the question is, so is there an interest in limiting this to seafood?
Well,
it's not clear to me why you would want to.
Well, I'm just wondering if there, do you guys enforce this record keeping on someone that raises catfish in Eastern Oregon?
Chair Deborah, Vice Chair Olson.
Shannon, could you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. For the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at Department of Fish and Wildlife. Currently, we have the authority to look at those records, maintain records, require fish health certification and transport permit. So we're not changing that for tilapia or any other species out there.
Okay. Thank you. Did you have another question?
No, that was, I'm just trying to make sure that if you're looking at a food fish in Eastern Oregon, that this covers it also. So the food, that's why I said seafood fish, because you seem to primarily be discussing seafood crabs and other fish, rockfish and stuff like that. And I didn't know if you actually required this commercial record keeping for catfish farm or a trout farm or somebody catching crappie, like I said. But you obviously do, so food fish is cool.
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, anything that's sold commercially, it's a broad term, I understand, food fish is. It pretty much captures it all.
That's fine.
Yes.
So currently you don't ask for all those records unless there's a problem, right? I mean, they have to keep them. They have to keep them. This bill allows you to go get some of that information, and it also allows you to go forward and backward, which it didn't do before.
Chair Denbrough, yes, and Senator Roebland, that is exactly right. Currently, the records are required to be kept, and when there's an issue, we can inspect them. The commission has given us the authority to inspect those records, as well as Oregon State Police, and this bill would then allow Oregon Department of Agriculture to access those records. They are not currently kept in a database somewhere. They are kept by the individuals who are part of that seafood or food fish commercial enterprise.
Great. Any other questions for the agencies? Okay, thank you both very much. We also have Gwei Kirshner and Greg Peden, please.
Greg looks like he's bringing trouble up with him.
Gwei, you want to go first?
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Gwei Kirchner, and I'm the Marine Fisheries Project Director with the Nature Conservancy. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to you in support of Senate Bill 1550. We appreciate that Senator Roebland introduced this bill and his ongoing support for marine issues and Oregon's fisheries. Roughly 2 years ago, the Conservancy began exploring the possibility of a new program to support Oregon's fisheries. We had conversations with over 100 Oregonians that directly were involved in fisheries and developed 380 project ideas that could improve state and federally managed fisheries. Based on those ideas, we launched our program and have begun to form partnerships and projects that can boost Oregon's vital marine habitats and improve the fishery stocks Oregonians rely upon. As part of our fisheries work, I'm here today to express support for Senate Bill 1550. We see this bill as a positive step forward in developing full traceability for Oregon's fish harvests. Seafood traceability is an important tool needed to ensure a strong future for Oregon's marine fisheries. Consumers are becoming aware of their food, the source of their seafood. They want assurance that fish is harvested sustainably and of the highest quality. They want to connect with the story of the fishermen who caught them. They also want to be sure their fish is safe to eat. To accomplish these goals, managers, seafood industry, marketers, and consumers need to be able to track fish harvest from the vessel to the plate. Oregon does not currently have a system in place that provides traceability through the entire chain of custody for seafood. We see Senate Bill as an important first step. This bill will allow the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Department of Agriculture to collect and share information through the entire chain. We support the application of the bill to all fish species. We think that this is insightful and reduces the need to return to the legislature in the future as future needs arise. Lastly, while not addressed in this bill, we believe that tools exist, such as electronic logbooks and electronic fish tickets, that if implemented in all commercial fisheries in Oregon, could provide close to real-time information. This type of timely information would be valuable to address human health needs like domoic acid contamination and help with other fishery management goals, including traceability. We are interested in working with partners in a collaborative manner to develop these tools and associated policies. In closing, we support passing Senate Bill 1550 as revised in the Dash 1 amendment, and thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today.
Thank you, Gwei. Thanks for coming. Greg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Greg Peden here on behalf of Pacific Seafood in support of this legislation. Just say briefly, as you heard from the department, this bill really ties together the ability of both ODA and ODF&W to work together to enhance the traceability that we already do. And to be clear, the Pacific Seafood and I believe others in the seafood processing industry already have very sophisticated traceability systems. It's just a question that the state doesn't own those. The state has a right to come in and inspect them, and that's what the law provides today, and this is what the bill enhances. I've asked Senator Roblin to draft one small amendment that is not before you, I don't think, yet. I think it's going to be in the same amendment that addresses the tribal concerns, and that's just simply a permissive language that says really to her point that the records can or may be kept electronically as well as paper. We do, as you can imagine, a lot of things by barcode, so the records are really entered in a lot of cases in that system, and it just makes things a little bit more easier to track and more responsive. So you'll see that little amendment coming forward. Other than that, happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg. Any questions for either of them? Okay, thank you both for your comments and the suggestion. Yep. Anybody else who wanted to speak to Senate Bill 1550? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing. This bill is scheduled for work session on Wednesday. Okay, so now I'm going to open up our public hearing on our third and last bill, Senate Bill 1509. Beth, you want to talk about this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1509 has a Dash 1 amendment that's posted on OLIS. The measure would remove an exception to current restrictions on idling of a commercial vehicle during loading and unloading. It also adds an exception for new 2008 or subsequent model year diesel engines that meet specific nitrogen oxide emission standards. It authorizes a local government to adopt an ordinance restricting idling adjacent to certain facilities, including schools, specified childcare facilities, hospitals, and residential care facilities, with certain restrictions. The Dash 1 amendment specifically would require any local ordinance adopted to be more stringent than the state restrictions that are in statute currently.
Thanks. Thank you, Beth. So, colleagues, this bill, Senate Bill 1509, is pulled out of the omnibus diesel bill that we discussed last year. It was a piece that there was broad consensus around this, and the you know, again, as Beth said, what it does is it removes the idling preemption that is in state statute under certain circumstances. So it allows local governments to pass ordinances that will designate idle-free zones that would then generate appropriate signage so that truckers would know they're in an idle-free zone, and would, you know, we believe, help with public health concerns. This is a problem with older engines, which don't have the filters that, you know, that filter out the particulates. Engines that were constructed after 2007 or that have been retrofitted are virtually particulate free, and so as long as they're certified idle, clean idle, they will be you know, exempt from the idling regulations. But otherwise they need to follow the idle free ordinance. So that's essentially what it is, and this seems like something that we can all agree to, I hope, and we can move this step forward. Obviously, there are other issues that remain around diesel engines, both on-road and off-road, and I believe that we'll be coming back to them next session. And we still have some dollars in the VW settlement fund that we are hoping to use to help with this problem. But for now, it seems that the sooner that we can move on this, the better. And the Dash 1 amendment just clarifies that the preemption is removed only in the case of a city passing an ordinance that is stricter than the state standard. It can't go ahead and pass an ordinance that would be less strict than the state standard. So with that, I'm happy to take questions. We have some people who are here to testify. Senator Roblin.
Okay, I will. I was waving.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead first. I'll do it.
Okay, Senator Benz.
Yes, I just had a question about the your last point. I was looking at the, I'm not sure if it's it must be the Dash 1s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just curious at how it is drafted. Couldn't it be more clear if it read must be or cannot be less stringent? The more it opens the door for how much more. So I think it's just a drafting issue. We could talk to who drew this. Is this Maureen?
Heidi.
Heidi. Heidi drafted. I would just.
She's listening.
Yeah.
Watch it.
Yeah, I would just wonder why it does not read cannot be less stringent as opposed to must be more. You get to the same place.
Yeah.
But it removes any argument of how much more.
Right. Yeah, I have received a couple of questions about that amendment, and I think your solution. I think is well worth considering. Senator Roblin.
I just had one concern that we talked about it, and that has to do with diesel engines in boats. And it never came up on it didn't come up much in the other one.
Right. We have someone signed up to speak, perfect. I think, to that.
Okay, that'd be great. Because yeah. I don't want us to do things that would make it impossible for those to dock in certain areas, because there are some of the ships that we have that refrigeration, pumping, all those things have to keep going, so they can't turn their engines off. So idling is not a good thing. So anyway, just wanted to make sure.
No, and I look forward to the testimony. It's such a fascinating process.
Because every time.
I don't think
know.
Anybody ever thought of that one. But
I know.
That's why we're here.
Yep.
Okay, so why don't we call up Jana Jarvis, Kyle Diesner, and Greg Peden, please. And why don't we go in that order? So, Jana, you want to start?
Oh. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. members of the committee, for the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Trucking Association. I did want to reiterate that Senate Bill 1509, as the chair alluded to you, was a consensus bill that involved the trucking industry, local governments, the environmental community, and it's something that we can support as it has been drafted. But the most important thing I want to leave you with today is that trucking companies don't want their drivers to idle their trucks, because fuel is one of the major costs borne by a trucking company, and idling burns fuel. And from the point of view of the trucking company, it's dollars that are going out of the exhaust stacks when they're idling. So many of my members have programs that they put in place to encourage drivers to shut off their engines and limit idling. And these kinds of programs range from cash bonuses to punitive measures. The current idling statute, ORS 825-605, essentially restricts truck idling to no more than 5 minutes in a continuous 60-minute period. But there are some occasions, and I think Senator Roblin alluded to them with respect to the marine industry, where a truck simply has to idle, and those situations are covered under ORS 825-610. This particular bill, allows local governments to further restrict truck idling at facilities with sensitive populations, the schools, daycare, hospitals, residential facilities, when the signs are posted. And it also adopts a provision that many other states, including California, that eliminates idling restrictions. It's late on a Friday afternoon, I apologize, for truck engines with newer emission control stickers, the ones that have the certified clean idle on the side. We were a little confused over the Dash 1 amendments as well, so I appreciate Senator Benz bringing that up. But I did want to close by saying that there are many states that allow unlimited idling for trucks that have the clean idle sticker. And with that, thank you for the time and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chair. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. My name is Kyle Diesner. I'm a policy analyst with the City of Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm here to testify in support of SB 1509. I've been with the city for 14 years, and over the last decade, I've worked on a number of initiatives to reduce diesel pollution. The health impacts of diesel emissions are real, and the Portland metro area has disproportionately high exposure to diesel emissions. Improving local air quality is a priority issue for the City of Portland. North Portland has the highest level of diesel particulate matter in the state, nearly 20 times the health standard, and most of Portland experiences higher levels of diesel pollution than the adopted standard. Diesel exhaust is 100 times more toxic than gasoline exhaust and includes fine sooty particles layered in heavy metals and toxic gases. Diesel PM is easily inhaled into the lungs, where it's carried into the brain and throughout the circulatory system. And diesel particulate has been linked to heart attack, stroke, brain damage, cognitive disorders, infertility, infant mortality, lung cancer, asthma, and the list goes on. In order to address the health effects, the City of Portland has prioritized improved air quality through replacements and retrofits of high-polluting diesel equipment, and that commitment dates back to 2006. We've retrofitted nearly all of the city's equipment with idle control devices and emission controls. However, addressing diesel emissions through our limited authority is exceedingly difficult, and the aggregate benefits of such action is limited. The city supports legislation that will give us more tools to protect the health of our residents. Local governments in Oregon are currently preempted by ORS 825.615 from enacting regulations on commercial vehicle idling. The proposed legislation, while helpful, still greatly limits the city's ability to pursue anti-idling policies in our commercial centers and corridors that are adjacent to multifamily housing and residential neighborhoods. The proposed bill limits commercial idling to K-12 education, childcare facilities, hospitals, and residential care facilities. Portland recently adopted a comprehensive plan, and we're focusing new growth in our centers and corridors, where new residents will have the best access to transit and commercial activity. By 2035, Portland will be adding 260,000 new residents and 140,000 new jobs. The proposed legislation does little to help the city protect air quality for residents and commercial corridors and the adjacent neighborhoods. Ultimately, we prefer and encourage the committee to consider a full repeal of ORS 825.615 or proposals to broaden the categories addressed in SB 1509 to include residential development adjacent to commercial corridors. However, today we're here to support SB 1509 as a small first step. In conclusion, the science is clear, and now is the time for action. The City of Portland appreciates the work of the committee on this issue and to reduce Oregonians' exposure to harmful diesel exhaust. We look forward to continuing to work with you to pursue this initiative alongside other legislation that more fully address all sources of diesel pollution. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Kyle. Appreciate your coming here. Greg.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Peden here again on behalf of Pacific Seafood. The issue that Senator Roblin, Beth, Mr. Chair, and I have talked about is an exemption to the bill as it relates to fishing vessels. Where I got stuck in reading the bill was that I could not find in statute a definition of the word vehicle that excluded a boat or a fishing vessel that may have a diesel engine in it. And if you think about this dynamic for the fishing industry, there may be, and I can picture one in particular, coastal town where there is a dock reasonably close to a school. And that dock nor the school cannot be moved. So the boat does no choice but to dock at the dock, and the school is the school. And so there is the figuring out the language here doesn't seem to work. So I put forward, asked Senator Roblin, put forward the amendment carving out fishing vessels, fishing boats. But if I'm wrong, or if there's another way to fix this, I'm open to any way to address this. I'm not trying to be overly difficult on that, but that just seemed to be the solution we could come up with. That's it for me. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Greg. Yeah, I personally, I'm committed to fixing this problem. Again, we'll be, the plan is to work this bill on Wednesday. Hopefully, we'll have everything in place before then. Senator Betrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just refresh my memory on the statute. Does this cover reefer power plants?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Refrigeration using reefer, you know, the refrigeration units on trailers. I can't remember.
So
open a Pandora's box.
You did, yes. Chair Dembro, Senator Bartsugar, that is one of the issues sometimes, but many of them have auxiliary power units, so they don't need to idle the truck. So it just depends.
But the separate power unit. Is what I did. Does it apply to that?
No.
Okay. Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall when we passed this years ago, a debate about who was going to enforce the law once it was passed. And I'm just curious if there's ever been a record of this law ever having been enforced.
I guess I would ask a question of Kyle. Have you all talked at all about how enforcement might happen in the city?
Thank you, Chair Dembro. As this hasn't been something we've had the authority to do, we have not considered any proposals. So I would have to defer that question to City Council.
Okay. Janet, do you have thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I was going to say I'd have to defer that question to Mr. Russell. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I recall us talking about it, the enforcement could come from police officers who happen to be there or parking attendants, parking squads maybe, could do it. That's as far as our conversations went. And I suppose a complaint by complaint as well.
Mr. Chair, if I recall the conversation, and we went around and around on this all those years ago, so I do recall it, we all were debating and looking at the law, allows the engine to idle for more than 5 minutes in any continuous 60-minute period, and then there's a series of exceptions. So you'd wonder who's sitting there with the stopwatch and then the proof of it. So it was well-intended. We just all wondered if it would make any difference other than to encourage companies, when they saw this, to try to instruct their employees accordingly, or their, if they owned a truck, to act accordingly. Anyway.
Thank you for that. Vice Chair Olson, then Senator Pezanski.
Sure. I have a question. You probably won't be able to answer this, but it kind of relates to what I do for a living. And we talk about the exception around hospitals. You can't be around hospitals or daycares. But as you know, a lot of times hospitals have a lot of work done on them, and you have concrete trucks that pull up, and those concrete trucks must keep turning to keep that concrete from setting up. And the exception here, it says, to power work-related mechanical, safety, electrical, or construction equipment installed on the vehicle that is not used for propulsion. But they use their main diesel engine, which is their propulsion engine, as the propulsion to keep the barrel turning on the truck. How do we reconcile that?
Janet?
Mr. Chair.
Should we call Bob?
Yes, we do. Could I call a friend?
That's right. Lifeline. You only get one.
Senator Pezanski, did you want to, were you answering
that? No, not that one. I've got another one.
Okay. My understanding, Senator Olson, is that cement trucks would be one of the accepted items. That when I spoke with this about this with Bob, that was what he was telling me. So my understanding is that they would be one of the exceptions.
We'll follow up I think
we would need to clarify that.
Thank you very much for that answer, and I think that we probably ought to look at something in the law so that there's...
Correct.
It's not, there's no ambiguity. And I hate to say that, but it's life. You know, you're working on school or wherever, the concrete truck sits there, and they've got big loads, and they sit there and they idle as that barrel turns very slowly, and then when they pull up, of course, then they dump their load and they're out. But in the meantime, they've sat there for a long time waiting for their... So I think we need to clarify that, would be my personal opinion.
Okay, we'll look at that. Thanks. Senator Pezanski.
So the attorneys down here all looking at the books and everything. I just looked up to see what a vehicle is, and the vehicle under the highway code or vehicle code basically says means any device in or upon which any person or property is or may be transported or drawn upon a public highway, and then it includes vehicles that are propelled, blah, blah, blah. So then you have to look at public highway, and the public highway seems to give a clearer indication that it would not apply to marine, because public highway, the only place it's defined is under motor carriers, and there it states that a public highway means every street, alley, road, highway, or thoroughfare in this state, and then it goes on from there. So it doesn't seem to take in marine highways, but it's interesting because you think back on the historical perspective.
That was the highway.
The public highway is how we got the open beaches.
That's exactly right. That's
there's a moment in history.
Yes.
Greg, you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Pezanski, I knew I was in trouble when I saw you reaching for the books there.
I was here to help.
You are. No, and Beth and I had this discussion, and things just got a little fuzzy was if a boat was on a trailer being pulled by a truck somewhere. Now, I don't envision a boat that's sitting on a trailer going down the highway as having an idling engine on the boat. But it was kind of got vague enough to where we said, well, let's put the amendment in and have this discussion again. I'm if the committee was under the consideration that boats don't apply, I think we're fine. I'm not, so that was, but I just wanted to share our thinking a little bit.
Well, one way or the other needs a legislative intent if we don't do a...
Exactly.
Yeah. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay. We will look at that cement truck issue to get some clarification into it. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to speak to this bill? I will point out we have Kevin Downing, the state's resident diesel expert, here in the room. He must have a pillowcase with him, but he could show us the difference between a clean engine and an idle engine. But take his word for it.
white chocolate and dark chocolate.
Okay, colleagues, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1509 and call this week to an end as far as this committee goes. We are adjourned.
Sorry about that, but I just...